Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast supported by Hunt Bike Wheels and Cotic Bikes. We're going to be chatting with Tani Seagrave in just a minute, but first up it's time for some listener offers. If you follow the podcast for a while now, then you'll know that I've been riding a Cotic Flare Max for a year and a half and I really love it. It's a short travel 29er with a bottomless feel to the suspension and it really enables you to push way harder than you'd expect to on a short travel bike. The steel frame enables the bike to respond to bumps that are out of plane with the suspension. That means that the traction is really incredible. And the long shot geometry just inspires confidence. Last week, Cotic launched an updated version of the Flare Max. It's now got 125mm travel as standard. There's a longer stroke shock to improve the suspension feel and a couple of degrees steeper on the seat angle to improve the climbing. There's three new colours too, Supernova Orange, Dark Grey and Red Dwarf. It's already an amazing bike, so I can't wait to have a go on the new improved version. You can check out the new Flare Max over at cotic.co.uk. And as a Downtime listener, if you purchase a Flare Max bike or frame before the end of December, then Cotic will throw in a free set of Bergtech composite pedals in too. Just add the code Downtime and the colour of pedals of your choice into the notes box on the online order form. Next, we've got a deal for you from Hunt Bike Wheels. Hunt strive to go above and beyond by bringing the latest technology and engineering to all things round, with the aim to create the best wheels for all types of riding. They've got an awesome range of wheels in both aluminium and carbon for you to choose from over at huntbikewheels.com. I recently interviewed enduro rider Matt Stuttard, who'd been running a set of their carbon wheels for the Enduro World Series, and he was loving them. Hunt wheels are available online or through your local bike shop, and Hunt will make sure you can always get in touch with someone if you need help with knowledge, parts, or servicing related to their products. For Downtime listeners, Hunt are kindly offering 10% off all of their wheels over at huntbikewheels.com for the month of December. Just use the code DOWNTIME10 at the checkout. That's Downtime, all lowercase, followed by the number 10. If you're enjoying the podcast and want to help keep it going into 2020 and beyond, then there are a few things that you can do. Tell your friends about the podcast and get as many people listening as possible. You can share the episodes on your social media, or you can head to downtimepodcast.com/shop and either grab yourself some of our merchandise or click on Share the Love to make a financial contribution of your choosing to help keep the podcast getting better and better. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you get every episode delivered to your device as soon as it drops. All you need to do is to head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and you'll find all the links there to help you do that. On that same page, there's a form to join our newsletter. We're not going to send you loads of emails or share your details with anyone, but you will get our weekend warm-up email every Friday. Once you've filled out the form, you'll get an email that you need to open and confirm your subscription, so don't forget to check your junk mail. All right, this week I'm joined by Tani Seagrave. Tani started off the 2019 season with a win at the opening round of the World Cup, only to be taken out in Fort William, leaving her with a serious shoulder injury. We chat about her career so far, dealing with injury, riding at the old Rampage site, the prospect of 2020 being the most competitive season in women's downhill ever, and much, much more. So, without further ado, here's Tani Seagrave. Tani Seagrave, welcome back to the Downtime Podcast.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Very well.
Excellent. Well, so last time, I was massively gutted after we did our interview because I was super excited for it and we had nightmare Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And it kind of made it pretty tricky. So yeah. We're in person this time.
Yes, yeah, still in Wales awesome. With a bad connection, but
we don't need it. Yes. So that's good. Yeah, I went and consoled myself with two Swift beers straight after that interview. I was gutted. But it's still there. So if people want to listen, they can go and check it out.
I'm sorry.
No, that's not your fault. But hopefully this one will be better. Before we get into riding, because you've been chatting about riding all day with people, I want to ask you about something else that's kind of close to my heart, and that's driving and cars. Mm. You've gone and got yourself a little project or a little toy. Tell us about the Mazda.
So I have no idea why I bought that. I wanted to kind of mess around in a car, so I got told by a lot of people that a cheap and cheerful car that you can actually spend a lot of money on, but a good project, was a Mazda MX-5. So yeah. I just looked it up on eBay. First one I found, 700 quid. After I'd won a race or something. So just you know, spent my bonus on that, and yeah, it was the start of a love story.
Happy days. What have you done to it? Have you made many changes?
I haven't really had the time. The only thing I did was I sprayed it black because I was scared that the police would recognize it after I did the donuts in the rugby car park.
You got in a bit of trouble for that, yeah?
Only a little bit, yeah. I had to do some work for the guys at the rugby club, but they were really nice guys, and I did apologize many times for using their car park as my playground, which was not cool.
Okay, fair enough. All good. And are you as fast in a car as you are on a bike?
People do say so, yes. Not many people choose to go back in the car with me once they've been in. Yeah. Well, some people do, but that's because they like the adrenaline rush of, yeah.
Fair play. I've heard you did a bit of a rally day and were going pretty well on that as well.
Yeah, I did. I did an experience day. I got it for my birthday a few years ago and I really liked it. Yeah, and the guys messaged me after asking if I wanted to get into rally driving and stuff, but I told them I already have a full-time career in mountain biking.
Fair play. Well, if this is a retirement plan maybe at some point.
A bit expensive for a retirement plan, but no, yeah. I do love it. I love driving my car fast. So, yeah, hopefully when I save up a bit and I can get into it a bit more.
Sweet. Nice stuff. Let's talk a little bit about your childhood. So you grew up in South London originally, yeah?
Yeah.
What was it like? Do you remember much about that time?
Not really. I can remember going to gymnastics, going to school and all that sort of stuff. I just remember liking all activities. You know, I love being around. My mum and dad were really sporty and they loved taking us out on weekends. And as I said, I went to gymnastics, I think, twice a week, and I loved that. So, yeah, and I love improving. You know, I love that sense of improvement. So yeah. That's all I can really remember.
Do you think gymnastics helps? Like a background in gymnastics helps for riding at all, like balance and body control and stuff?
I have no idea. Like, okay. I wouldn't be able to tell because I know a lot of people didn't do gymnastics and they seem fine on their bike.
Yeah, true, true.
But maybe, I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I'm not flexible now whatsoever, right. but like it was something I really enjoyed. And maybe, yeah, like the balance or the flexibility that it gets you at a young age and that mobility. I know that my mobility is really good and I think it probably came from that.
Yeah, cool. And do you remember the moment that your parents came and told you you were going to move to France?
I don't remember that moment, but I do remember leaving and being quite sad, but also very excited, scared. But, you know, I trust my parents and we were getting out of a bad place, you know, South London, Croydon. It wasn't the best place to grow up. And mum and dad just wanted the best childhood for us, which any parent does for a child. So my older brother, he used to get into quite a bit of trouble in Croydon. You know, he was at that age where probably about 13, wasn't very safe to kind of be out on your own. And it wasn't a nice place. So, yeah, other kind of went to the end of the spectrum and like, let's leave the country.
Let's get out of here.
Yeah, okay.
Cool.
Fair enough, yeah.
How old were you? Were you eight?
8 years old,
yeah. So what was it like? You moved to Morzine, yeah? What was it like kind of settling in?
Yeah, we moved outside of Morzine. So we were quite probably like a 10-minute drive. But obviously at the time, property was nowhere near as what it is now. And mum and dad bought a really run-down place. It was awful. But they had this plan. They wanted to do it up and have it as a chalet, and they made it work. It was a big struggle for my mum and dad for a long time, pretty much until we moved back here. But they say that, you know, every second of it was worth it, and we do what we do because of that. So I'm forever grateful.
Yeah. So it's Nigel Page, wasn't it? Came and stayed at the chalet and kind of that was a bit of your route into mountain biking.
Yeah, that's what I remember. I know that, you know, there are a few locals and stuff, but when I really kind of started getting into downhill was when the mountain bikers, the pros, would come and stay with us. And yeah, Nigel Page came with his girlfriend at the time, who was Vanessa Quinn.
It's a bit of an idol for you.
Yeah, and I remember watching her the year before at Worlds where she won. Yeah. So
that was in Leisure, yeah?
Yeah. So yeah, I was a massive fan, and she was lovely, he was lovely. They kind of worked together with my dad to get me my first little downhill bike. So yeah, I was extremely fortunate, and and, you know, hung out with the CRC boys, and I saw their way of life, and it was just, you know, their dynamics and all that was just something I fell in love with.
Cool. How old were you when you started racing?
I really can't remember. I remember Dad took me to some Mom Avalanches with Nigel Page, and they were like, well, the kids' version of the Mega Avalanche. And that's when I would meet Loic Bruni, and we must have been about 12, 13 maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe even younger actually. 12, I would say 12. But yeah, that's it's mad now to think that, yeah.
Well, back. What do you remember what your first race was like, or is that a distant memory now?
I wouldn't be able to pinpoint my first race, but I can definitely remember struggling. I wasn't very good at all.
Really?
Yeah, no.
So there wasn't like because a lot of races you speak to, they were kind of straight away, they were winning. And...
Yeah, no, I, because I kind of started a bit late compared to some of the other girls, and I would just get beaten by like loads. And that was fairly normal.
Well, yeah, I was going to say you've had quite a few nemeses already in your career. And I think, was it Sandra Renier?
Yeah.
Was one of the early ones. And obviously she beat you a few times.
Yeah.
Do you think getting beaten is good for you? Do you think it's been an important kind of part of creating that drive that you've got?
Yeah, I think it definitely built up my personality and the way I look at things and how I perceive winning and losing. At that age, it was all about progression. And, you know, my dad would keep telling me, one day you'll get there, you will beat her. So we just kept going. And it took like two or three, way actually more than that. It took like 4 years before I actually beat her. But when I did, it felt so good.
Did you ever get frustrated along that 4 years? It's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah. I think I got used to it, you know. I kept chipping away, so that was real nice to see. I kept getting closer and closer and closer, so it's not like I would take any step backs.
So
I can just remember being really excited, like every race I would get a little bit closer, and that was my way of, that they were my small wins, you know. That was me, that was why I went to races. I enjoyed seeing that progression and getting closer to Sandra.
Yeah, so it's time gaps that you were measuring then. That was your indicator of progress.
Yeah.
Nice. Good way to look at it. And then obviously you started winning and maybe started getting used to winning a little bit. And I think I've heard you say yourself, you maybe got a little bit cocky or a bit overconfident at one point and turned up at Junior Worlds in Leergang.
Yeah.
Kind of expecting to take the win. And Holly Feniak turned up with different ideas.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that race and how it panned out and what you learnt from that.
So, as you mentioned, I went through my whole first year of racing World Cups and I won them all as a junior. And my times to the elites weren't that bad, and that's what I was kind of aiming towards. They weren't bad, but they weren't great. Like, I wasn't nowhere near. I don't even think I made a top 10. So,
okay.
I don't know, Leergang was a bike park, so what I'm used to. I felt super confident going into there, and everyone kept mentioning Holly Feniak, and I remember seeing her in practice, and she was super fast, and it did kind of flood back those memories of, you know, just having that constant second place. And yeah. I think it just made me feel super uneasy. I remember... And Holly was super confident, walked around, like came up to me, we'd never met before, very, very confident. And I'm a very shy person, especially around new people. I might not come across shy, but I'm very closed off. It takes a while to break down my layers.
Okay.
So for me, that was very intimidating, seeing somebody very confident in their own body, like, you know, even at a young age, just confident to kind of strut around the place and as if you know everyone. So I remember feeling very, very intimidated and kind of defeat before I'd even started my race run. So I wasn't surprised in a way that I didn't win, but I was so upset by it. I was super upset by it because all year that's what I'd been looking forward to. You know, everyone said I was going to be world champion, and it was a massive learning curve. I learned so much from that experience. And it kind of shaped who I am, I guess, today. And, you know, I I'm thankful for how it went. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that kind of or outwardly projected confidence is an important thing at a World Cup event? Because I've definitely seen that in the men's field. Like, there's certain people towards the top end of the sport that you know, the chest's puffed out, and
that's the
when
thing
they're when they're outside of their own pit.
Yeah,
there's definitely like an aura that they project outwards. Is that something you're conscious of, or you know, to kind of almost take that mental high step before the racing even kicks off?
I think everyone's different, aren't they, and they kind of deal with it in their own ways. I feel like some people, they become like, if they are confident or they put that on, they start to feel confident, or people are just genuinely confident. Like, you can't really tell, but I know for me, I just need to be who I am, and like, I can't, I would never go into, I don't know, I'm just not, yeah, I wouldn't be that confident person. I can't come into a race. And I remember actually in Maribor this year, they wanted me to look at the camera, you know, for the TV stuff. They wanted me to look at the camera and say, I'm here to win. And I looked at them and said, I'm not saying that. I was like, I'm sorry, but I can't say that. And they were like, oh, it's just like, just look at the camera. I was like, nah, can't do it. I was like, I'm so sorry. I did everything else. I was like, but I can't do that. I was like, I am here to win, but I don't know what's going to happen, and that's not who I am. I would not come into this race and be like, I'm here to win, like, watch out. Like, that's just not me. Like, I'm here to race, and I'm here to have a good time, and I'm here to battle it out with everyone that's got a chance of winning.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm just not, I'm not that type of person.
Fair play. Good on you for standing your ground as well. It's cool. Well, and you, so you made up for it the following year, Peter Maritzburg, 2013 World Champs. Took the win there.
Yeah.
How did it feel to be a world champion?
It felt, I remember talking to Manon Carpenter about it, and it was exactly how she described it would feel, and it was a huge relief. It wasn't, it was weird. It was just, as a junior, I think when people expect you and you're an upcoming, you know, aspiring athlete, people keep telling you that you're going to be world champion. They keep telling you it, and it almost becomes, you know, it's pressure. It does put pressure on you, and you're like, oh my God, I've got this one chance now to become world champion before I move up to elite. So when you do get them, it's a huge relief, and I'm sure Valley Hole could relate to that as well. It's just, you're just happy that it's over, which is horrible, because that should be your moment. You know, you should be with it, and you should appreciate it, which I did, but it was much more of a relief than anything else.
yeah to tick it off, I suppose.
Yeah
get the pressure off your shoulders a bit. Yeah, fair play. So last time we spoke, I think it was early 2017, just before Fort William, and it was the stage where you'd been getting a lot of second places again, and you were looking for that first win, and it just wasn't quite coming together, but it did happen. Leagang 2017, I think, was your first elite win.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you changed anything in order to get that win?
Yeah, I changed quite a few things to do with even just my personal life, which, you know, I had a boyfriend at the time that, I don't know, just, it wasn't like a bad relationship. It just wasn't great. And it took a lot of time and a lot of energy, and, you know, it just wasn't, it wasn't a healthy relationship. And I, at the time, didn't see it as something that would be bad for my racing, because, you know, that was separate to my racing. But if you're not a happy racer outside, like, if you're not happy outside of racing, you're not going to be a happy racer. And happy racers don't, sad racers, don't do well.
Yeah.
So I kind of got to a part where I had to be selfish, and I thought, as you say, I had so many second places, and I was working hard, I was training hard, I was doing everything I thought that was right, and the only thing I could see that wasn't making me very happy was my relationship. So I think right before Fort William, that ended, and I had my crash in Fort William but I knew I was on pace.
Yeah.
And I got to Leagang and I just put my head down and I was ready to win. And I remember thinking in the gate, I was like, I am ready. Like, this is my time. And I took it. So it was another relief from a race.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, it was waiting to happen. And I remember again, I was talking with Manon that year, like, we went for a spin, and I said to her, I was like, I just feel like it's never going to happen. You know, I've just accepted that I'm never going to win a World Cup. And she was like, oh, don't be so hard on yourself. It will come. And then, yeah, there it was that weekend.
Again, maybe the weight off.
Manon's my lucky charm. And now she's gone.
Should get her on the team.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And you followed that up as well. Like, I think you took wins at MSA and Val de Sol that year.
Yeah.
You must have felt pretty good coming out at the end of that season.
Yeah, that season was good. I wasn't, Leagang was a relief, and I wasn't so happy with it because obviously Rachel wasn't there.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
In a way, I was happy that it got out the way while she wasn't there, because it was more of a, it was focused on me. It wasn't, mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking about her, I wasn't thinking about anyone else. So that kind of, I followed that through to the next races, and I was extremely happy with Mont St. Anne. In particular, because it's such a gnarly track, yeah. And I won by a big amount. And that's how, if I win a race, that's how I want to win a race. That's how racers want to win a race, you know, fair, square, and by a big margin. Yeah. So that is probably to date my best race.
Okay, yeah. Really? Even over the Val de Sol victory, because that's another super gnarly track.
Yeah, that was also that was a surprising one, because I hate Val de Sol.
Most people seem to
it's
find
so
it
scary.
A struggle. Yeah.
It is so, so scary. You're not only that, you're knackered when you have to hit these scary features, so it's double scary.
Yeah.
So I didn't expect that one, but the Mont St. Anne one was very controlled and I just felt very ready, and I kind of worked very hard for that, whereas Val de Sol was more of a hit and miss type thing.
Okay, yeah, so the process worked well at Mont St. Anne.
Yeah, like I'm happy it paid off.
Yeah,
like, because sometimes you put a lot of work in and it doesn't pay off, whereas Mont St. Anne it did, and everything went well, and it showed, and the result that I wanted showed.
Yeah.
Whereas sometimes you do all that work and you're either come second, or you'll win by a tiny margin because you made a mistake. So that race, I feel like it really showed what I'm capable of on the bike.
And you could see it. It was one of those runs where you can tell straight away, that's another level. Like, this is a winning run.
Thank you.
No, it was cool. It was good to watch. Really good to watch. And so 2018, coming in, I guess, feeling pretty good from previous season wins and a strong off season. Took the win at Fort William. Took wins at Val de Sol again, Val Nord, another gnarly track on the circuit. But you had that unfortunate moment in Leagang.
Mm-hmm.
Talk us through that from your perspective, like what went on, and how did you kind of process that, I guess?
So Leagang, I had a point to prove, obviously, after Fort William, because Fort William, Rach and Pom Pom both crashed.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's not unheard of that me and Rachel have a very competitive relationship. And in Fort William, she qualified first. Or I can't remember, maybe Pom Pom, but 10 seconds ahead of me.
Yeah, it was
and
a big chunk.
And she made that well known.
And I remember seeing you the night before, I think, after qualies.
Yeah.
And you were like, that is a big gap. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, right. It was a huge gap, but I'm not one for known to go in for it in qualifying, and it was a big gap because it's a long track. Usually it would be the same amount, but like 4 or 5 seconds on a smaller, more tedious track. So it did get me down. It always gets me down, but in the back of my mind I knew that it wasn't impossible, and you know, once I'd actually come to terms with it, I knew what I had to do. So I had a very good run that day. I had a real fun run. I was like enjoying it, and I had top splits that were faster than anyone, even before the girls went down. But obviously it's a hard one to swallow because of the circumstances that happened for other people.
Yep.
So I went into Leagang really wanting to back that win up more than anything. And I think I put so much pressure on myself that I'd crashed in qualies. I put a hole in my hip that we had to stitch up. And then I was still ready to go the next day. Like, I was thinking, nothing's going to stop me to get this win. But the fact that I just focused so much on that win, was like, looking back now, it was never going to happen.
Right.
The whole run from top to bottom was, well, from top to that mistake was going messy, but I knew for a fact that I could pull it back on the motorway, because I knew that I could put 2 seconds into anyone on that motorway. And that's a nice feeling to have, because I knew exactly where I could pump, pedal, like, and just splits. And throughout the weekend, you find out where your strengths are, obviously.
Yeah.
So I absolutely went for it on the motorway, and there was a tailwind as well, and I just hit one of the jumps, and I was going way too fast, and I didn't get the backside, landed to flat and got squirrely, and I just shot off outside of the tape, kind of rode on the tape, on the poles, got back in onto track, missed a couple of jumps, had to pedal up a hill, clearly lost time, finished third, 3 seconds back, and I was like,
yeah.
I was like, oh, that was so, like, I was like, if I hadn't have done that mistake, I could have won this, that, and the other. I was like, oh, never mind. Like, still points towards the overall.
Yeah.
Next, like, it'll be better next time. And then I get Hannah my flowers, all this, and then I kind of go over to Dad, and I was like, did you? And he was like, yes, I saw, everyone saw. And I was like, okay, well, what's happened? And then a commissaire comes up to me and says, oh, you've been disqualified. And I was like, but I didn't. The rule is, if you don't lose time, you don't. If you don't lose time, you get disqualified. Obviously.
Yeah.
It wasn't intentional. I never meant to go outside. Like, it was clearly like a mistake. But according to them, I went outside the tape, and yeah, that was it. Disqualified. We later had a chat with the guys, and they ended up changing the rules because I didn't actually go. I was on the poles and on the tape.
Yeah.
So we've changed it for anyone who, you know, in future does the same, which is great, but I lost valuable points and ended up missing out on the overall win. Purely because of that one race.
Yeah. And how did you deal with that? How do you kind of move on from that? Did it bother you? Like,
no, not at the time, but I guess at the end of the year when there were 2 points between me and Rachel, it stung a lot. But at the time there was a lot of drama, a lot of other racers, you know, who point out the fact that you went out the tape, you know, as I already know I've gone out the tape, like, I don't need reminding. There's just, you know, the emotions were real heightened, and all I wanted to do was just put it behind me, move on.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I did.
Strong mind.
Yeah. I guess so. I don't know.
Well, I want to talk about that a bit, because you've, in this previous off season, you've, I think for the first time, done some work with a sports psychologist. How have you been getting on with that? What kind of stuff have you work through? What have you learned from it?
So I got to the end of that season and thought, what else can I do? Like, I train really hard, my body, but I don't train my brain in any way, or I try to on like some apps and stuff, but I don't know what I'm doing. Like, we have a professional to come in and help us train, or like come in and help us ride bikes. But so I thought, well, let's do it, let's try it.
Yeah.
I got in contact with my sports psychologist, and we had a few meetings, and then we got to know each other a bit more, and we just chatted about a lot of things, and he kind of puts things in perspective for me. He figures out how my brain works and what my personality is like and what would work best for me, and we work on that together, and he just puts things in a simple way, so and it really helped going into 2019. I felt like I was on a different level. It was, you know, it didn't matter if my body wasn't prepared, because the mind's so much stronger.
Fair play.
Type thing. Yeah. But I was prepared. But I'm just saying that's how strong it was.
It's been a big thing, yeah. And is it kind of just those chats, or does he give you techniques and things that you can use at the events to kind of help you?
Yeah, for sure, like techniques and stuff. And like I say, so I thrive off of like work and getting the job done and progression and being in control of those situations. So I will have to, during that weekend, take things into my control and things that will better my performance. So that is what I thrive off. That's what makes my brain happy. So if I do that, then we're in a good state of mind.
Yeah.
If something goes wrong, I won't be that bothered because I'm in a good state of mind.
Cool. So yeah, just comfortable, happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. And so 2019, like you say, you went in feeling good. I saw you obviously take the win at Maribor, first time in the leader's jersey, good place to be. And I saw you, I think, just before track walk at Fort William, and you seem really confident and like ready for it. But I've read in an interview, you said you kind of knew that first day of practice, like you knew it wasn't going to be a good day, like you had a bit of a feeling.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, I don't know. I felt so good in Maribor. I was physically, mentally prepared. Like, I've never been as strong. And I don't know. Like, after Maribor, I trained even harder, like, because we had that four-week gap.
Yeah.
And there was no reason why I couldn't go and take another win, especially in Fort William after the year before. Like I said, another kind of chance at redemption there. So, I don't know. It was just the weather was so bad. And the whole atmosphere, like the whole pit setup, everyone was hiding because the weather was so bad. There was no one around. It was dark. It felt like it was nighttime. It was so cold, like no one would have wanted to ride their bike. Like, not a single person in that pit area would have wanted to ride that bike.
Yeah.
And you could feel it. You could feel the tension. You could feel that riders were scared. Like, it just wasn't a very nice atmosphere. And it's the first time I've ever witnessed that at a World Cup race. You know, usually it's full of excitement and people are ready and you can feel the fire in people. It's like, but it was just the complete opposite. And I'm very sensitive to how other people feel and I feed off of other people. And I just think, you know, that wasn't a good environment for me to be in. So I kind of tried to put myself in a good position. I did things to make me, you know, brain happy. But it just, you know, some things you just can't avoid. You just can't get rid of it. Like, no matter how much you try and shake it off, you just can't. So I don't know. I think I would have hurt myself that day no matter what.
Right, yeah.
I just don't think I was ready to ride my bike but had to type things.
So. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was very lucky that someone donated me an umbrella that day because it was horrific. Like, if anyone that wasn't there, the rain was biblical.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, this is the first time I've ever been at a bike race. Glad that I don't have to ride a bike.
Yeah, no, it was awful. I don't think like any of the cameras did it justice, and you couldn't see the state of the track. But me and Rachel were actually in the gondola together beforehand, and despite our competitiveness, we still chat.
Good.
No, we were talking about the track, and she said, "I wonder how bad the weather has to get before the track gets bad." She was like, "It looks pretty bad." I was like, "Nah." I was like, "Fort William never changes, no matter how bad the weather is." Like, and it's true. Usually the track stays exactly the same. Yeah. But I soon realised when I hit the deck with my face that there were holes, bogs everywhere. Like, it was insane.
Yeah.
Like, our bikes didn't work because they were so cold and wet. The brakes weren't working. Suspension wasn't working. It was just horrible. Yeah. And when I went down, I was almost like, well, that
was going to happen.
Yeah, that was going to happen.
And where you crashed, hadn't they moved the tape a little bit? So, because it's like a blind crest, isn't it? And it's sort of, it sent riders slightly different to normal into a big hole, basically.
It's, so I was quite, not glad, but when I went down and I was like looking at social media after that evening, I saw about 8 posts of people that went down. Cade went down exactly the same spot as I did. Amory, Loris, I think, Brayton.
Jack Redden.
A lot of people went down in that spot. So I felt slightly better because originally I thought it was my own mistake.
Right.
But yeah, it's a blind crest that's been there for years and years and years, and you know exactly where to put your wheels. But the tape sent you, because it's blind, the tape was pointing left rather than forward.
Yeah.
And you just follow the tape. You don't realise when you just follow the tape. Even if you've ridden there a million times, you follow the tape. And I went to push down after the crest because there's usually a pile of rocks and they're like a nice part, well, nice kind, inverted
Fort
commas.
William nice,
a blind crest, and you push into the rocks to get the downside and hit the patch of dirt at the bottom. But I pushed down and there were no rocks because I was in the wrong place. I wasn't where my wheels were supposed to be, and it was super confusing, obviously, because I pushed down and I just pushed down into nothing. So I almost like pushed my bike away from me type thing. But yeah. When I hit the ground, it was a huge bog. So I just I've never had a crash so fast. It was just, and not only that, because I was close to where my wheels should have been, where the rock garden is, that's exactly where my right shoulder landed. So the first thing to hit was my right shoulder into a rock.
Yeah. And you knew it was done at that point, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. As soon as it hit the floor. But I didn't get any pain originally because of the shock. So I kind of remember it happened, and like obviously it might crash in, like everything that you get in your bike in your face. Like I had a crank in my neck. Like it was all a bit like mental. But once I finally stood up, I was like, oh, like, I was touching like all my body parts. I was like my head. I was like, oh, I feel all right. But one thing I noticed is I actually could not move my arm. And I looked over to Boris, who had been taking pictures, and he just looks at my shoulder and then looks me in the eye with like a face that you just never want to see being looked at you.
Yeah.
And yeah, I knew then. And then the pain kicked in. And
yeah. And you had to wait a while to get off the hill, didn't you? Because they were extracting some other people as well. So.
Yeah, it wasn't nice. It was a long time before I got any painkillers as well. I was there for 2 hours. The side of Fort William in the torrential rain, and like obviously I had to sit down because I couldn't stand up, and I was in the bog, like, because you know what it's like.
Yeah, everything off the track is
like
bog
in it? Like, I don't know, 10 centimeters deep of bog, just sat there, no shelter. Chris luckily was there, and he came over with an umbrella. I'm so lucky he was at that point. And yeah, and it was a very, very long time until I got the painkillers and the drugs, and then all of a sudden everything went real quick.
You're like, yeah.
I was warm again. And
happy days.
But no, it was, at one point I remember actually saying, screw this, and like getting up and trying to walk and just fully collapse, because I thought, I don't know, my brain was like, I'm going to get up and walk to the gondola and get myself down.
Yeah.
And my body just wasn't capable of doing it.
Mad. Crazy stuff. But I guess this is the point where it comes kind of handy being a Red Bull athlete, because they definitely support people well and help through injury recovery. That seems to be a specialism of them, I guess.
Yeah.
Being involved with extreme sports athletes, what, like, on a simple level, what kind of treatment did you have to have? What did you have done to it?
Yeah, the level of support is second to none. Like, I cannot believe, even like sat here now, what they've done for me. So big up to them. So first thing that happens when an injury like that is we phone Darren Roberts, Aka the Conehead.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of contacts and he knows his way through, and he's the man. So so we contact him. He asks what's happened. Obviously at this point we don't really know, but we definitely know that there's something wrong with the shoulder. So yeah. He gets in contact with the shoulder specialist and they're all ready to go. So they're ready to see me and all that. But first of all, quickest way for me to get an x-ray is go to Fort William Hospital, get an x-ray. Obviously an x-ray does not show AC joints or ligament damage. All it will show is the collarbone displacement to your shoulder. So I was told by... the lovely nurse that was working there that day that I would be completely fine and I should stand up and pull my shoulders back.
Oh.
Which, obviously, I then felt very bad for making a scene, but also looked at my dad and said, there is no way that I'm fine. We sent over the x-ray to the specialist, and he said, you need to come in for an MRI as soon as possible because you have a grade 3 AC joint tear, whereas in the hospital they told me I'd have a grade 1.
Right.
And
so
anyway,
three's as bad as it gets, right?
No, 5 is
as
bad.
Ah, right,
as it goes
that high.
Yeah, 5
okay.
is real bad. 5 is a complete tear of the AC joint. So at this point I'm like, oh, it's not too bad. I'll be all right.
Yeah.
We drive home and I go to get the MRI, and turns out it's a lot worse than we thought. The ligaments are completely torn, like there's no way of saving them.
Right.
And the AC joint is, grade 3. So usually with the AC joint grade 3, you don't need surgery. You don't have to have surgery. Uh-huh. But for somebody at a high level competing and wants to be back 100%, this is necessary if you don't want problems in future. Because he could have, we could have left it. I could have crashed on it again. Could have got worse. Could have, you know, the score.
Yeah.
And my ligaments never would have healed because they were too far apart to heal together. So basically, we chose surgery in the end because it was much more safe and reliable. The surgeon pretty much told me that I didn't have a choice anyway. Like, it was the better option. So yeah, that have had a bit of Kevlar wire in my shoulder that pulls the AC joint back into place and that lets that knit together. But the most important thing that people forget were the ligaments holding my collarbone in place. And they needed about 6 weeks, sorry, 8 weeks to heal because they were in a very bad state.
Right. And you took a, yeah, took a chunk of time off then and worked your way back up. But gives you a lot of time. It's very unusual to be away from the racing. Like, you haven't really had a big injury, I guess, that's taken you out for very long. How was that period? Like, what was it like? Kind of, I'm guessing there was a bit of time in a dark place for a while, but how did it feel to be away? What did you learn from it?
Obviously, I try and keep in a positive mindset because that's all you can do in situations like that. I did have some extremely down days, especially right after the surgery when you don't really know what's going on and you can't actually move. My pain block didn't work in my shoulder when I had surgery, so when I woke up they had to put me back under for a bit because it was just the pain would have been way too high, and that, so they had to slowly wake me up on morphine, which kind of puts you out of place for a few days, and I had to keep taking that morphine for a few days.
Yeah, that's not nice.
No, so that was I hadn't for a few days. I had no idea where I was or what time it was, so I couldn't really think about much, if I'm honest. But after that, it kind of every day got a bit better, but I couldn't help but, you know, there was a World Cup coming up pretty fast. I couldn't help but resent the people that were healthy, you know, and racing. And it's hard for me to admit that because I only want the best for people that are racing, obviously. But it was really, really hard to sit back, and especially when you've never felt so good.
Yeah.
But you're always going to be at your strongest when you crash, because you're always going
hell for leather. Yeah.
So yeah, it was hard times, but I made myself go to the races and get stuck into a different job and kind of be around, so kind of learn more and learn about the other athletes, learn about my competitors in a sly way. No, I was just trying to widen my own, I guess, my own knowledge and see what I could learn from it.
Yeah, so you treated it as a bit of a research project to kind of understand more of the sport.
I got involved with Red Bull TV, did a bit of that, all the live stuff, which was scary. Didn't really have time to look at any of the riding, really, but, you know, I interviewed some of the riders, some of my own competitors, and I saw different sides, you know, some that it was just different. And I think I walked away with a lot more knowledge than I ever would have done before.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about the especially the live feed stuff, because for someone who says I'm not an outwardly confident person, mm-hmm. I'm quite shy, it's not the most obvious place to put yourself on live TV in front of millions of fans. Did you get any training or like take a sort of behind the scenes a little bit of that?
No, I didn't have any training, and I wasn't supposed to go live. So that I was in a good position until something happened. One of the riders crashed, I think, and there was an open window and I was at the top of the track. So they just asked me to talk about what the atmosphere was like, how it was like having the pits at the top. And I just said, okay. And before I knew it, the red light was on and I didn't have time to really think. So I felt like at the time in my head, I was kind of a bit like, oh my God, what am I saying? Like, is this coming out? Are they words or like, am I like, and then it kind of shut off. And then in my earpiece, the whole crew started clapping and whistling and saying I did a really good job. So I thought, can't be that bad.
Job done. Nice. So you enjoyed it then? It was a good experience.
Yeah, it was a lot of work though. I was running around like a headless chicken. I was like trying to get interviews here and there, and it's hard interviewing your friends and competitors especially. But Yeah, I did enjoy it. Yeah.
Good stuff. We'll have to get you doing my job for a bit, then I can have some time off.
No, happy days.
Cool. Well, I mean, the season kind of ended pretty good, I guess. Like, considering the Fort William crash was pretty significant, a lot of time off the bike, but you clearly focused hard on your rehab, got back on a bike just, or a downhill bike just before World Champs. You must have been pretty happy with that result.
Yeah, I was super happy with that. It was funny because I got a message from Coned saying, I told you to come first, not second. And he's the only one that kind of knew, I think, that deep down that's why I was there. I didn't go to come second.
Like, right.
I went there to, deep down, obviously, this is, I would never mention that, never mention it to anyone or even myself. But as a racer, it doesn't matter how much time off you've had on, like, off a bike, doesn't matter what people have done in that time. As soon as you're in a start gate and there's the clock's ticking, you want to win.
Yeah, the mist comes down and you're off, right?
But that race was super special. The whole lead up was completely different. Mindset was completely different to any race I've ever done, obviously. Me and Pom Pom spent a lot of time together. We trained together, you know, we went riding together in Whistler. Every single practice run in Mont St. Anne, we rode together. We helped each other out, like, on her weaknesses, my weaknesses, her strengths, my strengths. And I think it got us to where we were that weekend.
Yeah, so, it's amazing to see.
Yeah, it was nice. It was something we shared together. And we're really good friends, so it was so nice. And we couldn't believe it because we were sat in the bar in Whistler at the end of the day's riding. And we were saying, we were like, imagine if we did first and second. And I was, like, laughing. I was like, yeah, as if. And she was like, I reckon we could do it. I was like, well, you can go for the win and I'll try and get second then, because I'm not ready for that. And she was like, I don't care if you win, as long as I come second. I was like, all right, let's do it.
And you did.
Yeah.
Nice.
And that's when we were on the hot seat, and when obviously Trace is the last person to come down. And there's a certain point when you know if you won or not. And I knew that Pom Pom would. I didn't know if I'd come second because I couldn't really tell. But at that point, I knew that Pom Pom was going to win.
Yeah.
And I kept nudging her, and I was like, oh my God, as if, like, I was like, literally, like, 10 days ago, we were sat at that bar saying, like, imagine. And, you know, she'd never won Worlds before, so it was...
mega.
It was an insane moment.
Yeah, cool.
Very much appreciated that.
Nice, and a good after party, I suspect.
Well, actually, I was knackered. I was absolutely, completely drained. I worked so hard towards that day, and every second of the day I worked, so I had some dinner, nearly fell asleep at the dinner table, and I just had to go and sleep. So there was no after party for me, but I did hear that Pom Pom had a very good after party.
Good, I'm glad to hear it. Good stuff. So obviously since the season you've been cracking on with a few other bits and pieces, and I think most people will have seen the Red Bull formation, is that right?
Yeah.
That you were out in Utah on the old Rampage site.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that project and yeah, how it went from your perspective.
So I got told about this project before I'd even been in Whistler. So at this point, I wasn't really riding that much, but I knew it would be in October time. Yeah, so I took up the offer to go out there with a few of the girls and see what we could do. That's what it was. That, you know, there was no media-based things. Like, there was nothing involved. Like, nobody was told about it. Just Red Bull funded it, and they just wanted to see what they could do with a few girls out in the desert.
Yeah.
I think Katie selected the girls very wisely in a way that she wanted people that were calculated, that had experience, a lot of experience on downhill bikes, a few tricks, and just people that she thought would come and just be very smart about the whole situation and not have much to prove, you know. But no, that went very well. The whole experience was insane.
Yeah. What was it like riding on that terrain? I'm guessing it's like nothing you've ever been on.
Yeah, I've said to so many people since I've been back, if there's one place I would recommend to go is Utah. It's like a massive skate park for downhill bikes. It is insane. Cade was absolutely in his element. Like the exposure is pretty crazy. That was scary.
Yeah.
And it took time getting used to that, and like the ridges and hiking your bike up and all that's really, really intimidating and makes you feel really uneasy. But kind of got used to it over time. We didn't have much time there, so we had like, we kind of had to be smart with what we were doing and digging and like the features we had in mind and stuff. But as I say, it all went really well, and like, yeah, the dirt is just so moldable with a bit of water.
Yeah.
And after time, we kind of realized, we're like, oh, we could go bigger and better than this. But we only had 2 days digging, never been there before. So we kind of stuck to something that in our eyes was like doable,
yeah.
Still scared us, but doable, so that in future years we can go back and, you know, just keep widening our comfort zone.
Yeah.
So that one day it would be pretty big, I think.
Awesome. Well, it looked pretty big anyway, to be fair. Like, it wasn't a dumbed down line. I wouldn't have gone down it at all. It's a fair play.
Thank you.
Yeah, it looked mega. It's cool to see that side of the sport getting pushed as well. So
yeah, no, I was sold on the idea straight away. So.
Yeah. It's a bad time of year, I guess, as a racer to get injured, because you want that full off season opportunity to get fit and strong for next year. Were you cautious of it? Because I'm guessing it's a fairly easy place to have a big crash.
Yeah, and like my shoulder's not 100%, so I'm still every day trying to make my shoulder better. So anything I do is kind of gravitated around my shoulder, which is quite annoying, but at the same time keeps me very calculated and within my own limits. So there are a couple of things that kind of scared me a bit, but I don't think I was scared of like hurting myself again, because I've done that and I got over it. So I thought, well, no, if I can do it. So there wasn't that unknown anymore, uncertainty of not.
So it sounds like the injury really has kind of given you a bit more perspective and confidence, maybe, do you think?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. I was very scared before, because I'd never got injured in a race season, like we mentioned. And I'd never had to come and fight back for the top step. And I now know that that's possible. Even if it wasn't the top step, I was within reach and I wasn't at my fittest. So that was a big confidence boost. And it kind of let me know that you can crash. That's okay.
Yeah.
But obviously I don't want to.
No one wants to.
No longer that uncertainty of, especially I was worried about my shoulders before, so, and now I'm like, well, I can get them back to where I want them to be.
Yeah. And is there any reason why it won't be 100%? Like, is there any lasting?
I don't think shoulders are ever 100% after you've done them, which is sad, but they can be pretty close.
Yeah.
So. I don't doubt that it won't be as strong as it was the crash.
Yeah, cool. So looking forward to 2020 then, I think it feels like we're going to be heading into probably the most competitive women's season ever.
I mean,
you've got yourself, Miriam, and hopefully Rachel as well back from injury. You've got the younger riders like Nina and Marin Cabaru kind of clearly coming into form. Valley Hole taking a step up into elite. How do you feel about it? It must be pretty exciting.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I would love to turn up to the first race and see the start list with every single name down. It's what I thrive off. I love the competition. I've never liked ones where we lack, you know, the times are quite like hugely separated.
Yeah.
It's just, whereas with that list of names, it won't be, and guaranteed it won't be. And even like other girls, you know, Veronica and all that, who took this season as, you know, they took the opportunity. Like, it was great to see, because there was obviously doors that opened and places on the podium that showed up. And instead of the girls, like, it gave them a confidence boost. So, and not only that, they started riding a lot better and with more confidence, and it showed. And it, to me from the outside, it was really good to see, because I was like, girl, you should be riding like that, like, even when we're there, like, why not? Like, but it's self-belief, you know, it's people's mental games, and that's what usually separates the top from the bottom.
Yeah.
So I'm super excited, because it's not, as I said, it's not just the names we mentioned, but it's going to be good.
Yeah, and it maybe makes those wins even better, right? Because the stronger the field, the better the win.
That's what's so exciting, because you think, oh, if I win one of these, like, that's a good win.
Yeah.
That'll feel good. But it's just nice to have that competition and have those nerves and the excitement. And yeah, it's not easy. It's not an easy game. It never has been, but now it's even harder, which is cool.
It's good, and it makes it even better for spectators and us fans, I think. Like,
no, I'm super excited. I think what I'm most excited to see is obviously Vali and what she can do, because she's had multiple podiums already. We just don't see it because she's not in our category. And obviously I was injured this year, but she took the win, a couple of races, overall wins, which is super impressive. I never managed to do that as a junior. I'm not sure if maybe Rachel might have done it when she was, I don't know. So she hasn't beaten me yet in a finals run. Don't worry, I look very closely at those times. And even in snowshoe, I think that she was like 0.2
okay
behind me or something, and that's the closest we've ever been. So I'm very excited. She's an athlete already. She's a professional athlete now, so let alone what she'll be in, you know, with the experience that we've all got and at our ages. So I'm so excited.
And you followed her down Maribor for the IXS Cup preview. I remember watching that.
Like, oh my God.
This girl can ride a bike.
Yeah, no, it was cool. We'd only, to be fair, both of us had only had, a couple of runs down the track at that point. But she was hooning already, and I saw a few of her lines, and it put me in a good spot. And it was fun, like, because we don't really get to ride together. And I really like Vali. She's a real nice girl. So it was nice to spend that time with her and see her ride, like, actually see her ride and ride behind her. It was nice.
Yeah, she's definitely got some skills. It'd be good to see.
Yeah, the bike handling skills are impressive, and I kind of see her riding a lot like mine. It's very similar, very like, it looks, not that it looks lazy, but you know, there's not much movement going along, but at the same time it's very playful.
Yeah,
and that's what's real cool.
Yeah, nice. Well, it's off-season time, and that means it's team rumours season, as ever. And you guys, FMD, have sort of found yourself in the middle of that this year with talk about different bike potentially for next year. How do you feel when all the team rumours stuff's going on? Like, is it, do you enjoy it? Do you ever want to sort of stir the pot a little bit? Or is it kind of a hindrance?
I do stir the pot a little bit, because it is quite funny, obviously, when seeing all the rumours and stuff. But I guess people are interested. You know, it's exciting times, and people want to know. So I don't know, but everyone has to wait.
Yeah.
I have to wait, they have to wait. It's the way it goes.
Does it make it hard, like, if you want to get any work done, let's assume maybe you are moving bikes, can you go and do testing and riding? Like, do you have to hide away somewhere? Like, how does that all work?
You can, but yeah, you have to go somewhere where there's not going to be anyone. It's just, I think for any team, any person that's changing bike brands, it's just, you know, you owe that respect to the brand that you're with.
And, yeah.
The time that you've spent with them. And it's just, I think, it's just morals and respect.
Yeah. Fair play. Good stuff. Well, we're getting towards the end of our time, so we'll wrap up. We've got four questions that we normally wrap up with. We did the £150 question last time, so if anyone wants that, they can go back to the previous Wi-Fi struggle of an episode. So we'll hit those remaining three. First one, if you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give her?
I'd probably tell her that it's okay to be who you want to be. Like, you don't have to change your ways or try and, like, be a certain person. I was quite lost at that age, I think. I didn't really know what I was into, what... I knew I liked riding bikes and racing bikes, but, yeah, I think that I didn't know my style. I think I was very shy at school, and I wasn't confident at all. And, like, now I feel like... because I found something and I love it, and it makes me happy. That makes me confident, and, you know, I don't care who looks at me or who thinks I'm wearing too much pink or whatever. So, yeah, I think I'd just tell her to, you know, just calm down. It doesn't matter what other people think.
Good stuff. Second question then, if you could have a coaching day with anybody, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
That's a hard question, because obviously it's mad, because I see all my heroes on a daily basis in the summer, and I do get tips from them and stuff, but I wouldn't mind going, I don't know, that's a hard one, because there's a lot of inspirational people, but
You can have a couple if it helps.
Yeah, if I could go to Travis's backyard for a day, Pastrana,
yeah.
with all of those people, I think I'd have so many questions for them because I think they're absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
His whole family, his wife, like, he used to be a pro skater. And, yeah, just ask them what the hell goes through their minds when they're doing stuff.
I'm sure you could make that happen.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Pastranas for sure.
Yeah, cool. And then the final question, what do you do every day that you feel benefits you?
What do I do every day that benefits me? I don't know. Probably like my trying to stay positive about things. Like if you do it every day, a little bit type thing, it kind of becomes normal. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Making it a habit, yeah. I guess.
Cade's very easily like, what's the word? Not like set off. Like small things will kind of, you know, annoy him or.
Okay.
Because he just. And I feel like that's a good way for us to kind of be like, you know, the world's got bigger problems than stubbing your toe on the side of you. You know, let's sit down, let's breathe, yeah. and move on.
Nice. So you're bringing perspective to both
I
of
like
you.
To, yeah, I like for us to kind of just, yeah, think a little bit maybe outside of the box and put things in perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, in the grand scheme of things, you're both in a good place, right?
A very good place. Yeah. I try and tell myself that every day. Very grateful for what people have done for me, where I've got and who I am, and I would never ever take it for granted.
Good stuff. It's a nice place to wrap up then. If people want to find out more, follow what you're up to, where's the best place? Is it Instagram these days?
Yeah, I just put everything on there.
Cool. And at Tiny Seagrave?
Yeah.
All one word?
Simple as that, nice. If you can spell it.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes for people that struggle with the spelling.
Good luck with that.
Job
yeah.
done. All right, well, thanks so much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to sit down for a chat. And yeah, wish you all the best for next season. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you very much.
Nice one. Cheers.
Bye.
All right, that's it for this episode with Tani. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to Hunt Bike Wheels and Cotic Bikes for supporting the podcast. Hunt have very generously offered Downtime listeners 10% off all products for the month of December using the code DOWNTIME10 at the checkout over at huntbikewheels.com. That's Downtime, all lowercase, followed by the number 10. Head over and check out what they have to offer. Cotic have just launched their brand new and very awesome Flare Max, and as a Downtime listener, you get a free pair of Bergtech composite pedals with any Flare Max frame or bike order before the end of this year. Just put the code DOWNTIME and the colour of your choice for the pedals in the notes section on the online order form over at cotic.co.uk. If you've got a couple of minutes, then leave us a review wherever it is you listen to the podcast. Give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast and share the love at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Also, please spread the word, tell your friends about the podcast and share our episodes on your social media. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, get out and ride.